All right, today is Thursday, November 21st. We're going to start in your course pack around page 127. That is the beginning of special senses. So I thought I'd start you with this picture. Hopefully you can make out an image in this picture. What do you see? Yeah, there is a tree there. And there's a dog there, yeah. So you're right, there's a tree up top here. It looks like it's providing some shade. There's a dog, the head is down, looks like eating grass or something. There's front legs, back legs. So I thought this was kind of a neat picture to show because what your brain does, not your eye, but what your brain does is it takes bits of information and creates a pattern for us. So a lot of what our brain is doing is pattern recognition, and our brain, of course, has to be exposed to vision in order to have a pattern to recognize. Those who have never seen before, their brains never get to this point of being able to do pattern recognition. So we, of course, have eyes that feed information into our brains, and that's really what we're going to focus on today. So let me start you off with the external eye structures. They're on page 127. We have a couple of parts of our eyes on the outside that help provide protection for us. They include eyelids, which are lined with a moist mucous membrane on the inside. And you'll notice another term there called tarsal glands that help to secrete a fluid that keeps our eyelids from sticking together. You ever woken up with sleep in your eyes? That crusty, sticky stuff? That's a case where the tarsal glands have made too much of their secretion. So if you've had an eye irritation, maybe you've had, you know, been outside on a windy day, maybe you've been outside on a day where there's been smoke in the air, viruses can do it. Anything that irritates your eye may cause those tarsal glands to make too much of that sleep, that crusty stuff. So they're primarily there, those tarsal glands are primarily there to help make sure that your eyes don't stick together. You know, would not work very well if your eyelids shut and then you weren't able to open them back up. So it's kind of an oily secretion that helps to get your eyelids back open again. Just recall the orbicularis oculi is the muscle that rings around your eye. What is the function of orbicularis oculi? Open and close your eye. Good. Of course, eyelashes help prevent items from getting into your eyes as well. And we do have a moist mucous membrane on the surface of our eyes. It is called the conjunctiva. Okay, so if you've ever had pink eye, you've had inflammation of that conjunctiva. Therefore, it's also known as conjunctivitis. And all sorts of things can cause inflammation of that conjunctiva. Everything from viruses and bacteria to, you know, windy days, smoky days, allergens, anything that exposes your eye to irritation can cause inflammation of that conjunctiva. Let's look a little further into the eye structures and now talk about the lacrimal apparatus, which includes two ducts that you see leading off here by the medial side of the eye and a tube that runs, or a canal that runs through the nasal area that carries those tears secreted by the lacrimal gland sitting on the lateral side of the eye down into the sinuses. So when tears are created, they are made up here in the lacrimal gland. Those tears drift across the eye toward the medial portion, and the tears are drained into one of these two lacrimal canals. The tears then drain into this part of your sinus, and then, of course, at that point, you can probably blow your nose or swallow the tears, and if it goes to your stomach, the tears and whatever's in them can be destroyed by digestive enzymes. So I want to make a point here because if you have dirty hands, and who doesn't? You know, the hands are, you know, in contact with everything. Unless you're washing your hands constantly, odds are you've touched something that you can contaminate your system with. So if you rub your eyes and you happen to put viruses into your eye, not only can you get inflamed conjunctiva, but now those tears wash whatever this is, whether it's a virus or bacteria, down into your sinuses. Now you have a sinus infection or a cold, and then hopefully if you swallow those viruses or bacteria, they end up in your stomach, which is kind of like a pit of hell. You know, nothing's going to survive in a pH of 1 or 2. So if you swallow those viruses or bacteria, usually your stomach will destroy that stuff because the acid down there is so strong. But it's interesting, we oftentimes don't think about, you know, we know not to touch our mouth all the time, but touching your eyes is just as bad because now you can introduce viruses into your eyes and into your nasal cavity. Let's see, there are 6 eye muscles that help to move your eyes. They are called extrinsic muscles. They are on the outside surface and they're anchored into the sclera, that hard, tough portion on the outer part of your eye. So the naming here is great, it makes perfect sense. There's a superior rectus on top, an inferior rectus on the bottom, a lateral rectus on the side, and a medial rectus toward the nose. We also have 2 oblique muscles. They kind of run angular. There's one here called the superior oblique and one down below called the inferior oblique. So these muscles help us move up, down, left, and right. And those obliques also help us fine tune how we're looking. So if you look at the point of your nose and cross your eyes, you know, you're looking at those oblique muscles also helping to fine tune that movement. All right, any questions so far about those external accessory structures? Well, the eye is actually a hollow organ, and it's like a ball. If you were to peel it from the outside, there's 3 layers that you would peel away. At the very bottom of your page, you'll notice there is a fibrous tunic that's outermost, a vascular tunic that is the middle layer, and then the innermost layer you'll notice is a neural layer. So if you were to peel, just like you would peel a ball or an apple, layer by layer, onion would be another way to think of it, you've got 3 main layers from the outside to the inside. Let me take you on over to the next page. Thinking way back to connective tissues. What is a common fiber type? Collagen, good. So when you hear the word fibrous tunic, you want to think of that tough, strong collagen fiber, because that's largely what we've got here, is collagen fibers making up that sclera. So the sclera is the dense part of your eye. You can see in this picture, it's what we call the white of the eye. It is a very tough outer portion of your eye. And that's where those extrinsic eye muscles are attached. Of course, you can't see those. They're back behind where your eyes is visible to you. The portion of your fibrous tunic that is clear is called the cornea. And the cornea is what sits over your pupil and your iris. So, of course, it has to be clear because you wouldn't be able to see had it become, opaque and not be transparent. This cornea actually is missing a bunch of blood vessels. So it's actually a good candidate for transplant from cadaver tissue. So when someone has to have a corneal transplant, it's one of the few tissues in the body that we can do so without risk of great rejection. So there's few white blood cells that can make their way into that cornea. That cornea can also be misshapen. If any of you have an astigmatism and have to wear corrective glasses or contacts for it, everybody's nodding, yeah. So if you have an astigmatism, then you probably have double vision or blurred vision and don't even realize that you have double vision. And so what that astigmatism does is it creates multiple images on your retina. So we can do surgery to correct that astigmatism, but a lot of people just opt for an easier route, which is to wear corrective lens or contacts that focus that image on one point instead of giving you multiple points. If you have headaches, you know, when you're looking at stuff, if you have blurred vision or multiple images, then odds are you probably have an astigmatism. All right, so let's take a look at the middle layer of your eye. It's called the vascular tunic. What does vascular mean? Blood vessels, yeah. So in this picture, you'll notice the blue ring on the outside. That's our fibrous tunic. That is the sclera. And if we come around to the front here, there's the cornea, that clear portion of the eye. That really tiny yellow layer in between, that is our vascular tunic. And just for, you know, given all 3 layers, this red layer inside here, that's our neural tunic. Okay, so the vascular tunic includes the iris, something called a ciliary body, and then a choroid layer. So let's talk about the iris first. This iris actually controls how much light comes into your eye. And of course, the hole or opening inside that iris is called what? Pupil. So we know that pigmentation changes the color of the iris. Genetics determine what color that iris should be. The darker the iris, the less light gets passed through into the back part of the eye. So there is actually a benefit to having dark colored eyes because you have less problem with light reaching the back. The more light that reaches the back, the higher risk we have for things like eye cancer. So it's not a great problem, but if you were to live, you know, with light colored eyes and little protection in a very bright place, then there is a risk there for more sunlight hitting that back part of the retina. So of course the eye opening here is controlled by muscles. That iris is going to basically respond to how much light it needs to let in. And sympathetic and parasympathetic control also dictates how much light can come through that iris. Which one of these images do you think is sympathetic control? It is this one, yeah, the dilated pupil. I had a high school science teacher, and you know, they told us this. We were talking about sympathetic and parasympathetic stuff. And he said, if you are interested in somebody, then your pupils will be dilated because of sympathetic nervous system control. Let me tell you, we did not make eye contact in that class after he told us that for fear of thinking somebody might get the wrong message. So yeah, sympathetic nervous system response dilates your pupils. Parasympathetic actually relaxes or constricts the pupils, rather. So pupils let in less light under parasympathetic control. Okay, so the three parts of the vascular tunic are the iris, the ciliary body, and the choroid. Let's talk about the ciliary bodies using this picture. Okay, so you ever been on a trampoline? Okay, you've seen a trampoline if you haven't been on one. Okay, so if you've been on one, you know, there's a ring around the outside, the bouncy portions in the middle, and then there's probably a number of springs that attach the bouncy portion of the trampoline to the frame, right? So if you're like three or four people bouncing like heck on that trampoline, those springs got to hold, right? Because you can make a problem with that trampoline. Those springs that hold that trampoline are the ciliary bodies. And the trampoline is the lens. So the lens is actually going to be what refracts the light. Nobody's bouncing on it, of course. But it has to change shape based on whether you're looking up close or whether you're looking far away. And the way to maintain, you know, the shape of that lens is to allow it to be flexible. And that's what those ciliary bodies, you know, are going to help us do. You'll notice that they do help anchor that lens over here to this choroid layer that starts and wraps around the entire eye all the way to the back side. And the iris actually sits right in front of those ciliary bodies. So think of them like springs on a trampoline, allow for the flexibility of that lens. Choroid, by the way, in this picture is actually a blood vessel rich layer. It helps to nourish the retina. And so that's going to be where we go next in talking about the retina. And there's another view of those ciliary bodies, you know, these strings, so to speak, on either side of the lens. Okay, so near the bottom of your page, let's now turn our attention to the neural tunic. Neural implies nerves, and the main component of this portion of your eye is called the retina. All right, so the retina has two layers. There's a pigmented layer and there's a neural layer. So pigmented layer is what actually gives the coloring to the eye to some extent, because light is able to come through and be able to bounce off or be absorbed by that pigmented layer in the back. If you have brown eyes, the pigmentation in your iris is going to block any pigmentation from this retina back in the back. However, if you have blue eyes or light-colored eyes, then we're actually able to see a little more of that retina pigmentation color. So the color of the iris is actually able to shade over whatever you might see from back here. Those pigments in this pigmented layer are meant to capture light and hold it. We don't want the light to reflect back out. You've ever taken a picture and gotten red eye? then the pigmented layer did not have an opportunity to capture the light and keep it. It just reflects right back out of your eye. So that is the whole purpose of having a pigmented layer in your retina. It's to keep and capture that light. Then we can turn it into vision. So if you flash somebody with a bright flashlight or a camera flash, the pigmented layer just reflects the light right back out. And unfortunately, that person is left blinded, right? So the whole goal is to get that image sent back to the brain so we can process it. You'll notice that pigmented layer also stores vitamin A for photoreceptors. Vitamin A is critical for good vision. What kind of foods do you get vitamin A from? Yeah, yellow, orange, carrots, peppers, sweet potatoes, pumpkins. So Thanksgiving food, right? So we, of course, have vitamin A that helps us with vision. We've always heard eat your carrots for good eyes, right? And so it has to do with those photoreceptors, which will use it. So in this image here, you can see the pigmented layer at the top. And from this point down, you're looking at photoreceptor cells. What does photoreceptor tell you? Images, yeah, so it's light detecting cells. We actually have two types of photoreceptor cells that we're going to discuss. They are called rods and cones, and they're the ones that are going to become stimulated by light and then send images back into the brain. Okay, so let me go back to this picture here. There is a point on your retina where images are the most clear. And it's this point right here called the fovea. It's short for fovea centralis. It is Latin. It technically means focal point. Okay? So that's going to be where you have the most image-forming cells, those photoreceptor cells, sitting. And that image that forms here is going to be relayed to this optic nerve, this bright spot here. And that will then take the image back into the brain for reception and interpretation. All right, so that fovea centralis actually sits in the middle of a little yellow spot. And on your sheet down there, that yellow spot is called the macula lutea. It's very bottom of your page. Don't worry about the bipolar cells and ganglion cells down there. They're just part of a pathway of relaying that message into the brain. But let's do look at the optic nerve at the very bottom of your page. That optic nerve, of course, is where we're going to start taking that image back into the brain. There is a blind spot inside that optic nerve where there's no ability to carry or transport images. Because most people have two eyes, you will probably never notice your own blind spot. But if you had to function only with one eye, then you would realize that there were certain parts of your vision that you couldn't see. And it's usually like right over here if you were to shut one eye. So we know about our blind spots in the car. It's because you're using two eyes, but there's an area that you can't see. Same thing happens here with this optic nerve. Okay, so let's talk a little more about rods and cones. Let me take you over to the top of the next page. All right, so rods and cones detect different types of things. They're both photoreceptor cells, but the rods are going to detect vision in low light. In fact, they're found more in the periphery of your vision, and they detect motion off to the sides. Okay, so imagine this. Imagine you're out at night, walking around your yard. I hate doing this in the summertime, because guess what hangs from trees? Moths, spiders. I do not want to walk through a spider web in my yard in the nighttime. Panic, right? Okay, so if you're outside at night where the light is low and you see something moving out of the corner of your eye, those are rods detecting that movement for you. It's not color vision, it is movement somewhere on this periphery of your vision. So rods are great for detecting peripheral movement. They allow you to see the difference between shapes when it's dark. So that's why if you get up suddenly in the middle of the night, you may not necessarily see fine-tuned detail, but you may at least be able to see where your dresser is sitting and where your bathroom's at. So you may not see much more than that, but that's what rods help us do, is seeing low-level, low light levels and also to see movements on the periphery. Okay, so they're what we think of as black and white vision, movement vision. Do you hate to drive at night? Anybody? Yeah, I know a lot of you, yes. Okay. Sometimes we hate driving at night simply because of myopia, which is nearsightedness. But for others, it may be a case of night blindness, which is a true vitamin A deficiency. If you have real difficulty seeing at night, it's possibly one of those two situations. Myopia can be corrected by corrective lenses or by contacts. But, of course, night blindness is noted here as a vitamin A deficiency. So it may mean that there is truly a lack of vitamin A in your body. That's not likely because we store vitamin A in our liver, so it's quite likely that it's a case of myopia, not necessarily vitamin A deficiency. Let's talk about cones for just a minute. Cones are what help us see in bright light. They're the ones that help us see bright, colorful images. In fact, there's three types of cones. There's red, blue, and green. And depending on what you see, they will light up for us and give us images in the brain. Of course, we see more than red, blue, and green. But those are the bright, light-conditioned photoreceptors. So what do you think you're primarily using in this room? Rods or cones? Cones, yeah. Cones are for color vision. I keep the C's together to keep me straight. Cones are for color vision. Rods are for night vision, black and white vision. Rods are for movement in the periphery. Okay, so we are not nocturnal animals. We go to bed at night, most of us do. And that is because we don't see very well at night. We see best during bright light conditions. We know other animals are great at night vision, so they must have more rods and less cones. So it just depends on how that animal operates. All right, so just give you a moment to see if you can see some numbers here. I might hit the lights. That might help make the contrast a little easier. There should be a number or a letter in all four boxes. You see them? Dee, I'm looking at you specifically. You know why?
He's a guy.
Okay, so color blindness, if you have it, is carried on an X chromosome. Males have one X and one Y. Females have two X's. So for a female to be colorblind, she would have to get it from her mom and her dad. That is highly unlikely. You know, it happens, but it's not that common. For a male to have it, he only has one X chromosome, only has to get it from his mom, because he gets, of course, the Y chromosome from his dad. So, yeah, if you can see all of those, then you probably don't have color blindness. There's more than just red-green color blindness. There's blue-yellow. There's other rare forms. And if somebody's colorblind, what do they see instead of red or green?
All browns are all gray.
Yeah, all browns are grays. Yeah, like shades of gray. Yeah. So, I see a 58 up here. I see that one really easy. 18. This one's hard kind of to see. There's an L and there's an E too. There's part of the E. It is real faint. And what do we have over here?
17.
Yeah, 17. It does. Just some more for fun.
Those are easy.
So colorblindness is completely genetic.
My cousin's red green.
Oh wow.
He asked his mom when we were growing up would put post-it notes on his hangers.
What to wear?
Which clothes and what color so he could wear colored clothes.
Interesting. I know a guy that would go on the I know a guy that had trouble. Well, as long as stoplights were hanging.
When he went off to college?
He dressed whatever.
Yeah, he just grabbed things.
He didn't care at that point. Yeah.
He never bought anything red. He never bought anything green because it was all brown.
True. He couldn't tell that. So I guess Christmas time with red and green was just all brown.
He hated it.
That would be interesting because your brain would never know any different. You just would not know what the colors look like. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, hard time to get her. I remember that. He's my cousin closest to me in age.
That would be kind of a different way of perceiving the world if you had to grow up with that kind of color blindness. Yeah.
Just makes me mad.
Yeah. I imagine that would. Knowing that you're missing out on something everybody else gets to see. I do want to tell you that what is put on your retina is actually upside down and flipped left, right from what's actually given to your brain. The image that comes through your lens, that piece that kind of refracts light, is actually going to flip the image upside down, and then your brain takes the image and flips it back right side up. And when babies are born, of course, they're getting used to seeing, and the brain has to very quickly learn how to orient the image so that they're seeing correctly. So there's a flip job going on in there between the retina and the brain to get those images working right. Let's talk about the middle of the page, cavities and chambers of the eye. So here is that lens one more time. That is the piece that changes shape to allow you to see either up close or far away. It is serving as a dividing point between the front of your eye and the back of your eye. So what we find behind the eye is, of course, behind the lens is posterior. What about in front of the lens?
Anterior,
good. You'll notice on your sheet that these are called cavities. What is behind the lens is a posterior cavity. What is in front of the lens is an anterior cavity. Okay, and so in those cavities, we have a type of fluid. In the posterior cavity behind the lens, we have a vitreous humor. And it's kind of like a jelly. It's like clear jelly, and it is helping hold the shape of the eye. It also is something that helps to refract the light on the back of the eye. So if you were to cut open an eyeball, and we used to do this in lab, we don't anymore. We would cut open sheep eyes, and you could actually take that jelly out. It's literally like having grape jelly that's clear. So, yeah, interesting stuff. The fluid up front in the anterior cavity that's in front of that lens is actually a liquid, and it circulates through little teeny tiny canals that are on either side of your eye. I don't believe they're labeled here, but the little tiny canals allow that fluid to drain out of that anterior cavity. You know, if anybody ever happens to have those canals get tight or close up, the fluid can't escape and it builds up and causes glaucoma, which can lead to blindness. So it is important that that anterior cavity fluid, that aqueous humor, can do its job and circulate like it's supposed to. Easy to remember this, A, anterior, A, aqueous humor. Posterior cavity has the V, the vitreous humor. Just keep it alphabetical and that keeps you straight here. The lens is the dividing point between the two. Don't worry about the anterior chambers. They're listed there on your worksheet. They're technically a little tiny part divided by your iris. The main two to worry about are the anterior cavity before the lens and the posterior cavity behind the lens. We're back to the lens again. It is supposed to be a fairly transparent, kind of a football-shaped structure that light passes through on its way back to your retina. And it can either fatten up or it can narrow down depending on what you're focusing on. And so there's muscles, those ciliary bodies attached to either side that help it flex and shape. So it's meant to be flexible throughout your lifetime, but as we get into our 40s, it becomes a little less flexible. And so people start having to wear reading glasses. So as you age, that flexibility tends to go away a bit. Even later in life, it's going to have still little flexibility, and it may now become cloudy. And that cloudiness is a condition called cataracts. So in that case, people may not be able to see at all. In fact, my mom had cataracts, and she thought that a chair in the house was green. And it was brown. It was brown as the day, you know. It was brown like dirt. And she had cataract surgery and had it replaced. And then she's like, you know, you're right. That chair is now brown, not green. She says the paint in her bedroom, she had a light tan, but it had a very strong pink tint to it. She thought it was a tan-colored paint. I said, nope, that's pink paint. So when she had the cataract surgery, she realized, yeah, that's pink. So, you know, they can still see, but it can become progressive and worse and block more of your vision. But obviously it was affecting her ability to distinguish between colors. So that's the cataract. Young people can have them. Cigarette smoking can induce cataracts. What's that?
UV.
UV can do it. Electrical exposure. And I mean this because dogs that chew on electrical cords can get cataracts.
I was like, yeah, I saw a dog in the water's
well, yes.
You had the eyes is like glossy, and I just kept looking at the lady dog like, oh my goodness,
what's going on? Plus, it's hard.
And she said, yeah,
yep, so if they chew cords or, like you say, welders, any kind of exposure to more electrical zaps can cause this to occur. So it is supposed to be a fairly easy surgery to pull out the old lens, pop in a new one, and then people can still see. Unfortunately, this, though, blocks a lot of the vision that goes through that lens. All right, so at the very bottom of your page, you'll want to highlight those two visual pathways. I'm going to walk you through those. Okay, coming through the eye itself, the very first structure that the light encounters is going to be the cornea. We now travel through fluid that's in the anterior cavity. That fluid is called the aqueous humor. The light now travels through the pupil. That is the opening in the iris. Through the lens, and the lens is flexible. It can get skinny, it can get fat, and its job is to help bend or refract light as you look at images up close or far away. Where do we go after the lens?
Yeah,
posterior cavity. We're passing through vitreous humor, and that light is now focused back here on the focal point in the macula. It's called the fovea centralis, sitting back there. And there's a high concentration of cones in the fovea centralis. That means that you see very best and most clear images when you've got bright light conditions. So from that fovea centralis, the information is relayed over to the optic nerve. And now we're going to go to number two. We're going to go back into the brain. So let's see, we're up here at the top of the image. We have now left the eyeball. We're traveling in optic nerves. And you'll notice that as we travel into the brain, those optic nerves cross like an X. Where they cross, it's called the optic chiasma. You'll notice now that we're inside the brain, and we know that because the name changes from an optic nerve to an optic tract. What does tract tell us? Yes, central nervous system. So we're now in optic tracts. We are traveling through the brain. We go to the thalamus, because why not, right? It is the relay station for all sensory info except for smell. So we travel through the thalamus, and we're traveling by these neurons that take pathways along each of our hemispheres. You might recall those are association neurons. They carry us back here to the back part of the brain. To what lobe? Occipital lobe. And should we head to the primary or the association cortex for vision first? Go to primary, receive there, and then we of course make sense of that vision in the association area. So just a little detail here, from optic nerve to chiasma. We now travel down the optic tracts. We head to the thalamus. We travel these association fibers, and we end up back here in the occipital lobe at the primary visual cortex, and then of course that association cortex as well. I just want to make a mention, you'll notice that these images that come off of each eye not only travel across this chiasma to the opposite side of the brain, but they also travel on their own side of the brain. Do you see any advantage to the way that works? Depth perception is part of it. And likewise, if you have two functional eyes but only half a brain,
it can still get all the information.
You still get all the information. Yeah, because you notice that both vision pathways go to both hemispheres of the brain. So Not that you would be able to see like you expect to see, but still there's the potential for that because those pathways go to both sides. Okay, so I'm going to let you read about retina and accommodation on page 130. Just a couple of terms there. Myopia, hyperopia. Myopia, of course, being nearsighted. Hyperopia being farsighted. And presbyopia being old-sighted, being 40s plus. So, of course, everybody's going to have presbyopia at some point, but not everybody necessarily will end up with myopia or hyperopia. Presbyopia means that you probably can't see up close and we'll need reading glasses for that. I would like to now switch gears and take you to the ear, but before we go there, do you have any questions on eye material? They're on the final, and they're going to be like a multiple choice setup, and I may ask you to like to pick the right flow. Good news is the ear is a little more straightforward and easy. So let me start you with the three main parts of the ear. We have an outer ear, a middle ear, and an inner ear. Most of these structures that you see are actually for hearing, but the ear actually has a second function, and that is for balance and equilibrium. So we'll get to that as we get into the inner ear portion. Okay, on the outside surface, we have a pinna or auricle. I just combined both terms, didn't I? Pinna or auricle. This is a sound collecting device, and the whole purpose here is to help channel that sound into our ear. And of course that ear canal is called the external auditory canal or meatus. So once we get into that portion, we are now moving into the middle ear, so I'll take you to that one next. The dividing point between the external ear and middle ear is this eardrum. What's the other name for eardrum? Tympanic membrane. Good. Okay, so that tympanic membrane will vibrate with sound, and the louder the sound, the greater the vibration, and that vibration will push against some bones in your middle ear. So right here is the tympanic membrane or eardrum, and there's three teeny tiny bones, malleus, incus, and stapes or stapes. These are the tiniest bones in your body. They are so cute. We used to have them in a boxing lab. I'm not sure if they're still there anymore, but they're like little baby bones. They're just so itty bitty. But they are the tiniest bones that we have, and they sit where they push against each other. So when sound waves vibrate against malleus, which is the hammer, it beats against incus. An incus now vibrates against the stirrup here, or stapes. And stapes, you notice, has a window underneath it. So it's this complex mechanism that magnifies the sound that you're hearing. And when stapes beats against that oval window, it shakes the heck out of the inner ear. And it creates sound waves and fluid. So it's like taking a bowl of water and beating the heck out of the side of it and watch those sound waves ripple across that bowl of water. Now, in that bowl of water, there are tiny hairs, and those tiny hairs are going to sway when the sound waves beat against them. And when those hairs bend far enough over, you can depolarize those cells, and guess what happens? You hear sound, right? So if the sound waves aren't beating strong enough to depolarize those cells, you won't hear anything, or you'll hear something that's not really intelligible. But if you beat hard enough with those three little bones against the window, against the fluid, and make the sound bend those hairs, you'll hear something. So that's what we're looking at, as a way to magnify the sound that's coming into the ear. All right, so the order of those bones, middle of your page there, is malleus, incus, stapes. You ever seen somebody beat a bass drum with their foot? They hit a pedal and that bass drum, it hits against the drum. That is exactly what this stirrup is doing. It is pushing against that oval window and shaking the fluid inside the inner ear. So when you have sound come in to the tympanic membrane, it vibrates malleus, incus, stapes. Stapes pushes against that oval window and shakes the fluid, creates sound vibrations in the fluid here in this inner ear area. It is. It's like the oval window's here, and the stapes sits on top, so it would just hit against it or shakes against that window. There's another window here. It's called the round window. It's down here. But, you know, that is not the one that the stapes is vibrating against, you know, creating those sound vibrations in. You'll notice that if you happen to have an ear infection, a true, honest-to-goodness ear infection, that means that there have been bacteria come into this little round window here. And you say, well, how in the world does bacteria get there? And the answer is here. Up your throat. Yeah. Okay, so let's think about this evil pathway. Dirty hands, rub your eyes. Viruses or bacteria travel in your eyes, to your nose, to your throat. Yeah, you may swallow it, but in your throat you have an opening to this eustachian tube. It's called the pharyngeotympanic tube. All sorts of different names for it. Any way you look at it, it's an evil pathway, because now viruses and bacteria travel up that tube. They come in that round window, and if they get in this area here, they cause a middle ear infection, and you feel awful. So kids that have an honest-to-goodness middle ear infection probably had bacteria sneak its way up that backdoor pathway. So as you age, you know, as you get away from being 1 and 2 years old, those eustachian tubes go from being horizontal to being angled down, and it's much harder for bacteria to sneak their way up into that backdoor pathway. So, or not. Yes, some of us still have middle ear infections as adults, right? So if you have tubes put in, then that would be a pathway to keep the drainage, keep the fluids draining down there into that throat area. Okay, so let me take you to the inner ear, which is a really complex part of the ear. This is where both hearing and balance are perceived. So let's take the bony labyrinth, the membranous labyrinths first. These bony labyrinths you can see are twists and curls inside the inner ear. There are fluids inside both these semicircular canals that you're looking at here. These three are called semicircular canals. And your cochlea, which is the hearing organ of your ear, that also has fluid on the inside. So when we change these fluids, that's when we have a sense of either hearing in the snail-shaped cochlea, or we have a sense of change of balance or head position in these three semicircular canals. So if you think about it, let me get you a different picture to look at. This kind of looks like a snail, that cochlea does, and that set of semicirculars kind of looks like a pretzel. So I think of it as a snail sitting on a stump eating a pretzel. The snail is for hearing. The pretzel is for balance, okay? So the cochlea is your hearing organ. On the inside, you have these hairs. And like I mentioned, if those hairs bend in the gel that they're sitting in, then you'll get a sense of sound from that. And something really cool about this, on top of this fluid that's in your inner ear, there are teeny tiny stones called otoliths, these little calcium stones here. And when you have, you know, movement inside one part of your inner ear, that will create a sense of balance. And of course, if those ears, if those otoliths get displaced, then you may have a sense of motion that still goes on in your ear, even if you're not moving. So fluids in both, hair cells in the cochlea, you've got otoliths over here in this vestibule and semicircular canal area. Semicircular canals are for balance and equilibrium. What is the cochlea for? It's for hearing. Good. All right, so I've actually taken you over to the top of page 132. All right, so let me tell you about equilibrium and balance for just a moment. We'll save hearing for the next page. In terms of equilibrium and balance, there's two things that are detected by your inner ear. One of them is static equilibrium, meaning your head's not in motion. So if you're sitting still and your head's not moving, there's no sloshing of fluids or stones in your inner ear, so you don't have a sense of motion. That's what we call static equilibrium. However, if you start moving, those fluids in your inner ear and that vestibule and semicircular canal area can start to move. And when we start moving, information is relayed to your brain by cranial nerve 8, that's vestibulocochlear nerve, and these two portions detect slightly different things. You'll notice that the semicircular canals detect rotation or angular movement. Let me put it to you this way. If you're going off of an exit ramp and you're spinning off of an exit ramp, you know how that curve makes you kind of feel like you're being slung? That is what the semicircular canals detect. Getting on a merry-go-round, great example of how those semicircular canals detect the spin motion. If you're simply going in a forward motion, that's going to be your vestibule. Or if your head leans forward or if your head leans backward, that's going to be your vestibule. So two slightly different types of movements there that are detected by two different portions of your inner ear. Okay. So let's focus on hearing, which is found on page 133. So just to review, which portion of your inner ear detects sound? Cochlea or semicircular canals and vestibule?
Cochlea.
Cochlea, good. Semicircular canals detect angular movement. The vestibule detects like forward motion. So the equilibrium and balance part comes from those semicircular canals and vestibule. All right, so let's focus on the hearing part. In terms of sound, we know that sound travels in waves. The louder the sound, the higher the wave. That means the higher the amplitude of the wave, okay? So we measure that in decibels. And the higher pitch the sound, like squeaky mouse noise, high-pitched sounds, we measure that in hertz. Low bass tones, we measure that in hertz, okay? So we're looking at a couple of features there of sound. And of course, the louder the sound, the more likely we are to disturb those hair cells inside the cochlea and create a depolarization that causes us to hear things in our temporal lobes. All right, so let's talk about the pathway of hearing. And that's the only pathway we're going to do for the ear. We're not doing any pathway for equilibrium or balance, just hearing. Okay, so when you hear things, we have to get sounds gathered first by the pinna or auricle. They are then channeled into this external auditory meatus. And the first part to vibrate is the tympanic membrane. That is the dividing line between the external ear and the middle ear. We now travel into the middle ear. The first teeny tiny bone to vibrate is the malleus. What is the second bone to vibrate? Incus, good. Okay, so that's your blank. And the third teeny tiny bone to vibrate?
Yes.
Stirrup or stapes, good. Stapes taps on the oval window. That vibrates the fluids inside this inner ear. Let's switch pictures. So here's stirrup or stapes. It sits on that oval window. It pushes against that oval window and vibrates the fluids inside our inner ear, specifically inside this cochlea. And there's little tiny hair cells inside that cochlea that now bend when the sound waves come and create a great enough disturbance in there. So if we depolarize those cells inside the cochlea, we can generate an action potential. And we now travel down this nerve, it's a cranial nerve, to the brain. What cranial nerve is this one?
Okay.
Number 8, good. And that is vestibulocochlear nerve. It is cranial nerve 8. And that is your blank there by step 6. Okay, so vestibular cochlear nerve is cranial nerve 8. It carries not just sound, it also carries balance and equilibrium information into your brain. All right, just to take this one step further, which lobe of the brain are we heading to with sound information? Temporal lobes, good. And of course, we pass through the thalamus. The thalamus routes it to the opposite side of the brain. And of course, we know that's how the thalamus is going to work as a relay station. I just wanted to mention to you the two types of deafness at the bottom of the page, conduction deafness versus sensory neural deafness. If a person has damage to the little tiny hair cells, and let me back up and show you those. These are hair cells inside the cochlea. They're sitting in fluid, and if there's vibrations that are coming that are hard enough, the fluid makes those cells bend. And of course, that's what causes us to have hearing. If you're exposed to loud sounds all of the time, those hair cells are always bending over and creating action potentials. And of course, if the sound is really loud, it can damage those very delicate hair cells. And when that happens, we say that a person has sensory neural deafness. It's nerve damage, right? So if you can't conduct sound into your brain, it's called sensory neural deafness. And you'll notice that a cochlear implant would be the situation that we follow if we want to give somebody the opportunity to hear. If you have conduction deafness, it could be something as simple as having too much earwax in the ear canal, or it could be something as simple as having those ear bones fused together. If those ear bones fuse together, they cannot amplify the sound, and the sounds that you hear just are muffled or not loud enough. So in that case, a hearing aid that makes sounds louder might be sufficient for somebody with that type of deafness. Worst case scenario, though, is having conduction deafness combined with sensory neural. Then you've got two problems that you have to address there. Tinnitus is sometimes called tinnitus. I've heard it pronounced 10 different ways. But however you look at it, it's ringing in the ears. And what we think is happening is if these little ear bones vibrate by themselves, if one of them is constantly doing this against its neighbor, then the vibrations are relayed to the inner ear. And what does that make you think you hear? Buzzing. Buzzing, clicking, humming, vibrating, whatever kind of strange noise that may come from those little bones. But if they're constantly doing a little vibration, then that may cause that tinnitus or tinnitus situation. I know we covered this fast. I know we covered a lot of content today. So to put your mind at ease, there are reviews at the end of the eye. You might have noticed that one. And here on the next page is review of the ear. And then below that, on the very last page there, 134, there are 7 questions on eyes, 8 questions on ear. Those are really close to final exam questions. So you want to make sure you can answer those before the final on the 5th. There is not a whole lot of questions on eye and ear. They're just mixed in with the rest of everybody else. So this chapter is just, part of the mixture.